There is actually another member of class who had to go back to work and is going to be listening to the recording, so you're not quite as lonely as you might think. We've got a very large topic and not very much time. So I'm going to be telling you about what first-order predicate calculus is. I'm not going to have time, and there is no time in the assignments, for you to get any experience of practice with doing stuff with first-order predicate calculus, which is highly regrettable. So this is intended to tell you about why it is, what it is, and a few interesting facts about it. As our roadmap says, I'm going to start with some things that we can't say in propositional calculus to motivate predicate calculus. Then I'm going to say, what does predicate calculus add to propositional calculus? And that's these next four things: predicates, functions, variables, and quantifiers. Then I'm going to tell you about the semantics. What do these things mean? How do we tell whether a formula is true or false? I'm going to talk about an inference technique called resolution, and this is going to be a horrible race through a rather interesting topic. It's basically there for completeness. There is no question about resolution or unification in the exam. Then, of course, one of the themes about this is computing with and on logic. And so we've got some interesting and useful results, one of which is about whether first-order predicate calculus is decidable. Okay, so the fundamental problem with the propositional calculus is that atomic sentences have no parts. If we've got two atomic sentences that are clearly semantically related, there is no trace of that in the logic. And the example I've given here is Abigail's father is Richard, that's my elder daughter, and Lily's father is Richard, that's my dog. Now these are semantically related. They're both about me, they're both about the notion of fatherhood, and one of them's true and the other one is false. They can't possibly be modelled by the same propositional letter. But atomic sentences in propositional calculus, two of these things, P and Q, they're different. P and P are the same. And when you said they are the same or they are different, you have said everything there is to say. Because in the propositional calculus, nothing depends on the spelling of a symbol. All that the spelling does is to let you say these two that are spelled the same way are the same, these two that are spelled differently are different. Well, this is what we want to say, or something like this. We want to be able to say things like father of Abigail is Richard and father of Lily is Richard, and that's false because this one's true and that one's false. Okay. So here we've got something, we've got parts, we can say, well, look, I see you've got father outside the parentheses in both of these things. That's something they've got in common. And we've got Richard as the second argument, and that's something they've got in common. And this bit's different, so they can actually turn out to have different truth values. So these things that I've just written down here at the bottom, they are still atomic sentences, which is going to sound crazy because if I said they've got parts. Now, atomic comes from Greek atomos, not cuttable. Atoms in chemistry and physics were called atoms because it was thought that you couldn't break them down any further. At least chemists can't break down atoms any further. Physicists can. Our very own Ernest Rutherford proved that. The thing is, this thing has parts, but none of the parts is a sentence. Father isn't a sentence. Abigail isn't a sentence. I can't just make a bad joke there. Richard isn't a sentence. I'm more of an encyclopedia. So that's a different joke. But none of the parts is a sentence itself. As a sentence, it is a point. There is nothing smaller that is a sentence.
Uh,
I would like, there are other examples of systems like this. For example, there's we've got context-free grammar, which we use for describing computer languages and input data. And the names of structures in context-free grammar are just words. They don't actually have any meaningful parts. There is an approach to natural language description called generalized phrase structure grammar, which got replaced by something called head-driven phrase structure grammar, which basically does this trick. It says, instead of having just words, we'll have words with arguments. And in the case of generalized phrase structure grammar, it turns out to be equivalent in power to context-free grammar, but it just lets you reduce the size of the grammar exponentially. So this idea of saying, let's have something that has parts, but the parts aren't things of the same kind. It's a trick that turns out to be useful. So what are these parts? Well, we've got two kinds of parts here. Going back in the previous one, we've got Abigail, Richard, Lily. These, when we give a meaning to the formula, these stands for things. So Abigail stands for my daughter who is living over that way. Lily stands for my dog who is that way. And Richard stands for this one. Okay. So these ones are actually proper nouns that stand for specific individuals, but more generally, they're like noun phrases and standing for things. Not truth values. Things. Now, this word phrase, universe of discourse. The universe of discourse is simply the set of all the things that our formula could be about. In different applications, we'll have a different universe of discourse. Just like in your stuff with beliefs and whatnot, you have worlds. And different problems would have different worlds that you were talking about. It's not the same thing, but it's sort of like it. And the word term is used for these parts that are like a noun. Term means one of three. It relates back to Aristotelian logic. There are other parts, and we've got things like here, father. So I can say Lily is living by writing living of Lily. And this thing has a name and an arity, which is the number of arguments it's expecting. The word arity is used to describe the number of arguments. And these parts, they stand for relations. They're a little bit like verbs, like the stated verbs. Now, strictly speaking, a predicate is a semantic thing. What we've got here is a predicate symbol with its arity. So I'm sorry about that. I mean to say predicate symbols. Now, you're familiar with terms. You've seen one, and you've seen one plus one. Those are terms. And you're familiar with relations. You've seen one is less than two. Okay. No mystery here. Applying a predicate to the right number of terms gives us an atomic sentence. So what I mean here is that... is there a pen here? That one greater than doesn't have a truth value. It's not a finished truth value. It's not an atomic sentence. Greater than zero isn't finished. It doesn't have a truth value. It's not an atomic sentence. 1 greater than 2, now greater than has all the arguments it needs. That's a sentence. So, at a minimum, in a decent logic, we want to be able to talk about arithmetic or group theory or family trees or something like that. We're going to need something a little bit richer than just names, or are we? Next week we'll be looking at something where there's just names. But for talking about arithmetic, we want to talk about things like 1 plus 2 and 4 plus 5. Now, 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 are okay, they're numbers. Names for things. Now, it might turn out that 5 stands for a lemon, and 2 stands for a melon, and 4 stands for a grape. These symbols don't have meaning of themselves. We have to say what they mean. Okay. In terms of the logic, all we can tell it says that 1 and 2 are different names, but we don't even know if they're names for the same thing. Or not. Now, what about these things like plus and times? And I'm using the convention of writing an underscore to show where the argument should go. Now, plus and times aren't numbers. And they're not truth values, and they're not predicates. They stand for functions. So plus stands for a function that takes two numbers and gives you another number. And times stands for a function. So one of the things that's a little bit tricky about things like logic is our notions of constant and variable take a bit of a beating. Okay. I mean, we normally think of 1 as a constant, but when it appears in the logical formula, it doesn't have any meaning until we say what the meaning is. In that sense, it's all like a variable. When we talk about plus, what's 1 plus 1? Well, you don't know until I tell you what 1 means and what plus means. For example, there's a field called Z sub 2, which has two values, and it's the integers modulo 2. So if we interpret addition as addition modulo 2, then 1 plus 1 is 0. In fact, when George I actually have a copy of George Bull's The Law of Thought and Whately's Logic. I need to bring them down and show them to you. I'm sorry. When George Bull thought about, in about 1850, he came up with this idea of using an algebraic formulation for logic. This was a new thing. And so his thought was constrained by the arithmetic symbols. So he took and exclusive or as his main logical connectives, because and behaves like multiplying zeros and ones, and exclusive or behaves like adding them. So we're going to call these things function symbols, because the function is the mathematical object that they're going to represent.
And we'll say that a function symbol can be combined with zero or more terms to give us another term. And in particular, some people distinguish between constants and function symbols. I don't. I say that a constant symbol is just a function of no arguments, because there's only a semantic difference. So here we go. A function symbol f of arity n stands for some function, and I'm using this calligraphic U for the universe of discourse. And it takes n values in the universe of discourse and gives you another value in the universe of discourse. We don't know which function it stands for until something tells us, and a constant symbol is just a function that has no arguments. Now, so far, what do we have? We've got propositional calculus enriched with terms made up of constants and functions, and predicate symbols applied to terms. So this gives us structured atomic sentences, but that's all it does. We can't say that Lily has a father. She must have. She wasn't produced by some mad scientist. She didn't appear spontaneously. We don't know who Lily's father was because we got her when she was 3 months old from the SPCA. She'd been wandering around with no identification, no chip, no collar. And so we got her. She must have had a dog, and that father, and that dog must have been some kind of fox terrier, because she's pretty much pure fox terrier. But in the logic we've got so far, we can't say Lily had some father. We have to say this particular dog was Lily's father, and we can't do that. So when it comes to representing knowledge, okay, one core interest in AI is how do we represent knowledge? And there are some kinds of knowledge that we can represent accurately by neural networks and do a really good job. And there are some where we really can't. And the ones where we really can't, anything that you use is going to have to be some sort of logic. Again, we can't say that 27 has a prime factor, which it does, 3, without exhibiting a particular prime factor. Nor can we say things about everyone. The classic example is all men are mortal. Men here meaning human beings. We can say if Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. But we can't say if anyone is a man, then that person is mortal. We need some way of referring to things where we don't know exactly what they are. In the logic, one thing we can do, oh, and by the way, did anybody spot the mistake in this? I must fix this. I swapped the arguments here. But it's also true, it is also not true that Lily is my father. That's not true. So we have a distinction here between failing to say anything about whether Lily is my father or not, and explicitly saying that she isn't. We can have negative knowledge and say that. And that's actually important because if we've got a fact like this in our knowledge base, then no model that we can see, that we would consider accepting, will ever make this true. But if we don't say anything, there'll be some models where it's true and some models where it's false. Or there could be. Okay. So that's one sort of vagueness here. We can, in addition to saying either this is definitely true or this is definitely false, we can simply not say anything. We can do that, but we don't have this ability to say somebody or everybody. I wish it wouldn't do that. So here's some uses of variables in mathematics, and I want to draw your attention to what they've got in common. Okay, over here, we've got the sum of f of x for every x in a given set s. Over here, we've got the product of the x. Here, we've got the union. This one has a different shape. This is the integral of f of x with respect to x varying from a to b. This one here is the limit as x tends to 0 of sine x over x. Now, why might we be interested in that, by the way? When x is 0, this is 0 over 0. Sine 0 over 0 is 0. But the limit as x tends to 0 of sine x over x is 1. That's clear and definite. In fact, this function has the name sinc, S-I-N-C. And over here, we've got something that you probably haven't seen before. It's called a lambda expression,
and it says that function of x, which returns f of x. And lambda calculus was invented in the 20s by Alonzo Church. It was developed as a foundation for mathematics, as a rivalry with set theory. It has become the foundation of a large number of programming languages. Because, you know, in lambda calculus, there are only two things: creating functions and applying them. And in programs, we create functions and we apply them. When Java 8 got anonymous functions, it is.
Okay. Now, what do these things all have in common? They're all using different symbols, but they've all got a very similar pattern underlying. There are things called variables, and a variable is bound by something which I'm calling an operator here, for want of a better word. Okay.
So the operator here is sigma or pi or union or integral or limit or lambda.
There's something that introduces that variable. Okay. So there's this thing out here that introduces the variable, and then there's this thing that it governs where the variable gets used. Skipping ahead slightly in this slide,
the name of a variable doesn't matter. Okay. Outside one of these things, it doesn't matter what the variable is. Okay. So if I say sum I equals 0 to n, the difference between these two sums, this one binds I and uses I, this one binds J and uses J, they actually mean exactly the same thing. From the outside, it doesn't matter what we call the variable. We can rename it to something else, and this turns out to be important. What the meaning is comes from the operator. So much so that in Martin Lerf's logic, we've got these things, we actually separate out lambda that's read as a lambda operator applied to that thing. Don't worry about that. But the key thing is we do have something here that supplies some meaning, and then we've got a symbol that we can choose freely as long as it doesn't conflict with any variable coming from outside that we also want to use. So if I wanted to do something like integral 0 to infinity sum over I equals 0 to n, okay, I can change I to almost anything. The integral of the sum of f of ix, I can change the summation variable to almost anything, but I can't change it to x, because that would then try to give, I'd be trying to use x in two different ways at once. But I can change it to anything that isn't x. Okay. So this is the idea. We've got this idea saying we've got these things that are symbols, they're variables, they look like words, they're often written as a single letter, but there's no law that says they have to be single letters. They're bound by an operator which provides the meaning about what it means to have a variable here.
And the actual spelling of the variable name doesn't make any difference. This is not new. You've seen this all your educated lives. Okay, now, so what, the question is, what operators do we want? Now, here are some classical syllogisms. Aristotelian logic investigated mostly syllogisms. And if you look up the Wikipedia page about syllogisms, you'll find more than you ever wanted to know. For a couple of thousand, now Aristotle understood that he hadn't covered everything in logic, but for nearly 2,000 years, people thought he had. Well, actually, that's not quite true. People in medieval times did quite a lot of work on temporal and modal logic. The question about whether the future is determined was obviously a very interesting one. If there is a sea battle tomorrow, somebody will win it. Does that mean that it's already determined that there will be a sea battle and who will win it? You know, how can we even say, if there's a sea battle tomorrow, somebody will win it? People were addressing questions like that. But Boolean algebra and modern first-order predicate calculus had to wait until the mid-19th century. So, all men are mortal, some mortals die, therefore some men die. That seems to be sound. And here we've got words all and some. Oh, pest. I touched the screen to point to things. Over here, on the right, we've got no fish is human, and some animals are fish, therefore not all animals are human. Is this right? Well, if there is some animal that is a fish, that animal isn't a human. So yes, it is true that not all animals are human. So this is the kind of thing. There's a whole raft of patterns that people worked out, and depending on whether which of these kinds of words they had and whether there were any negations and so on. So what can we say from this? This is stuff that people definitely wanted to be able to do in logic. Okay? Linguists have a name for words like these. Some, all, every, no, many, most, five. The name for this is quantifier because it says how much. That's what quantity. And so the symbols that we're going to use to introduce variables are going to be called quantifiers. And we've got two questions. One of them is, what are they going to look like? And the other is, what should they mean? Now, and in particular, why I want to make it really clear why there is a question about meaning. Here I've got something that says all unicorns are horn bearers. All horn bearers are dangerous. Those things are sharp. Therefore, some unicorns are dangerous. Now, in Aristotelian logic, this was a valid inference. It was taken for granted that if you said all unicorns are horn bearers, you were implying that there were some unicorns. There's a linguistic term for that as well. It's called a presupposition. Okay, and linguists have some lovely examples like the present king of France is bald. That's a sentence that is neither true nor false. For it to be false, I'd have to show you the present king of France and say, look, he's got hair. For it to be true, I'd have to say, look, here's the present king of France. See, like a billiard ball. But since there isn't a present king of France, it's neither one nor the other. It has a false presupposition. And in Aristotelian logic, basically, it was taken for granted that you were asserting your presuppositions to be true. You weren't allowed to say all unicorns are horn bearers unless there were some unicorns, or at least unless you believed that there were some unicorns. But we don't believe that there are unicorns. Okay, yes, there are animals that have a single horn, but no, they don't look anything like a horse. So what could we mean when we say this? Okay. We've got to figure out a semantics for this. It's not enough to have symbols. We've got to have a semantics. And that's the one thing I do get done in today's lecture. I do actually get to tell you about the semantics. So the symbols we use are an upside down A for all, and an upside a back to front E. Actually, they're both rotated. a rotated E for exists. These things were literally invented as rotating letters. It's not an accidental resemblance. So for all x, p of x, when is that true? Well, if you look at every possible value for x in the universe of discourse, and p is true of that every time, then it's true. If there's even one thing in the universe of discourse where it's false, then for all x, px is false. Existential just flips true and false. There exists an x such that p of x, if and only if there is something in the universe of discourse that makes p true, it's false if everything makes p false. And so we've got an analogue of De Morgan's laws. And De Morgan's laws involve negation and or, and under negation, ands turn into ors turn into ands, and negation moves in. Same thing with these things. For all, it's like an infinite and. It's and for this, and for that, and for that, and for that, and for that. Existential is like an infinite or.
There's a variety of ways to write these. Existential is always written with the back to front E.
It's usually written without the parentheses. I put them into symmetry. Universal quantification is often written without the upside down A, but that's just too confusing. Parentheses get used to so many things, it's just not fun. So I strongly advise you always use the if you do write the upside down A, we normally don't bother writing the parentheses. I've put them in just to make it really clear. By the way, there's a question about operator precedence, about the scope of things. These things are normally read as extending as far as possible to the right.
But not to the left. It's very confusing. Now, these are the ones that you will find in most standard accounts of first-order predicate calculus. I'm interested in the semantics, and I have to say there are other possible quantifiers, and some of them get used.
So, for example, bang x means there is at most one x that makes p true, and there is a unique x, back front e, exclamation mark x, there is at exactly one x that makes p of x true. And we've also got something that's closer to the Aristotelian version for all, where the subscript 1 says every x satisfies p, and at least one x does. So if I said something like, if I said something about unicorns, I probably want to use this one. Now, it's quite obvious that this one doesn't increase the power of our logic. There's nothing we can say with this all and exists that we can't just say with all and exists. For at most one and equals, what we need to say is bang x px means the same thing as there exists x p. For all x, for all y, p of x. Okay. If you give me an x and a y that both satisfy p, they must be the same. That's what at most one means. Now, the thing about this is that to define this, you've got to use equality. Exists bang, exactly one, that's exists plus bang. So it's if
we've got a logic in which we have equality as one of our basic operations, then exists bang and bang don't increase the power of our logic. But if we don't have equality as one of the operations in our logic, these operators smuggle it in and do increase the power of the logic. Okay. So, in general, what we're talking about here is we've got some formula that has this variable x, and we think about the set of things in the universe of physics that make that true. This, by the way, is another mathematical construct that introduces a new variable. I wish to point from time to time. Here we're introducing x, and the scope is within this expression. A quantifier makes an assertion about that set. For all says, the same things making P true, it's the whole universe. Exist says, it's not empty, not for all, it's not the whole universe, not exists, it is empty, unique means this thing has exactly one element. And we could have other quantifiers that talk about the size of the set. We could say it has an even number of elements, it has an odd number of elements, it has exactly 5 elements. Okay, we could do this, we normally don't bother. But if we try to develop a richer logic that lets us talk about things like most people have hair. Then we need to say something about maybe saying, well, the size of this particular set of solutions is at least half the size of the universe. Now, that's not a quantifier. I've actually played with that when I was an undergraduate. It's not a quantifier that's easy to reason with. It really isn't. Because most people have... most X is a Y and most Y is a Z doesn't mean most X's are Y's and Z. Okay, so now we go on to syntax. Syntax of terms. A variable is a term. A function symbol applied to terms is a term. Nothing else is a term. So if we want to prove things about the logic, we can do induction proofs on these. These are trees. Terms are trees. Writing a function infix, that doesn't make any semantic difference. We can write x plus 1, we can write plus x1. It's the same thing either way. Doesn't matter. When we talk about terms, we can say with the idea of there are variables, there are constants. These things can be glued together to make bigger terms. We don't really care about how that's written.
The semantics is what matters, and how do we find out what the term means? We need three things to work out the meaning of a term. We need to be told what the universe of discourse is. Okay. If we're talking about arithmetic, it makes a difference whether we're talking about 0 and 1, all of the natural numbers. Okay, for example, let's try something. This isn't actually terms, but never mind, you get the point. There exists x such that 1 plus x equals 0. If our universe of discourse is the natural number, that sentence, there exists an x such that 1 plus x equals 0, is false. There's no such x. If our universe of discourse is the numbers 0 and 1, it's true, just take x equals 1. If our universe of discourse is the rational numbers, it's true, take x equals minus 1. Okay, this is a little anecdote, but it really is on topic. I was in my fourth year at university. I was a frequent visitor to the computer center and had lunch with the computer center people from time to time. And at one of these lunches, I happened to remark that I couldn't understand the difference between cardinal numbers and ordinal numbers. And I was referring to set theory. And in set theory, the first infinite cardinal, I'm really bad at drawing an aleph, aleph sub 0 plus 1 equals, now let's do it another way. Aleph sub 0 plus 1. Okay. If you take a copy of the natural numbers and another copy of the natural numbers, put them together in one set, you've got exactly as many as you started with. This is one of the paradoxes of infinity. On the other hand, if you take the first infinite ordinal, we have omega I couldn't understand this difference. Why do the cardinals and the ordinals behave so differently? Finite cardinals and finite ordinals are exactly the same. They behave exactly. When we talk about the natural numbers, we never bothered to say, are we counting how many or which in sequence? Because whatever interpretation we take, we get the same answer. But when we turn to set theory, how many and which in sequence are different? And I was having trouble getting my head around this. I eventually understood it about 10 years ago. And I was told this stupid little, one of the people there smugly told me this stupid little story about Johnny was helping his mother in the kitchen and she was giving him beans and he was cutting off the ends and putting them in a pot. And she said, now, Johnny, give me 5 beans. And he said, she said, give me 5, meaning she wanted 5 beans. Cardinal, how many? And he said, I don't remember which was 5, meaning ordinal, which in sequence. And yeah, cute, cool joke. That's not what I was talking about, although I didn't actually say that. I just shut up and I thought, idiot. Which he wasn't, but he... Okay. The thing here is, the symbols are the same. The meaning is different. Knowing what we don't even know, whether plus acts like this or like this, until somebody tells you, are you dealing with the cardinals or the ordinals? So we need to be told what the universe is. Then we need to be told what the function symbols are. And this thing is called an interpretation. An interpretation tells you what functions the function symbols stand for. And we use I for that as a capital I. Finally, we've got to give meanings to all the parts of a term. And that's there's functions and there's variables. So we need to have a meaning for the variables. But the whole point about the variables is, given a particular interpretation, the variables don't have a fixed meaning. When we introduce a new variable symbol in a formula, that's going to take on other meanings. So we need an assignment that maps variables to you. And so for part of this, I'm going to use calligraphic M for a meaning function, and this is going to have an interpretation and an assignment, and then there's going to be something plugged in here that say, what is the meaning of this given an interpretation and an assignment? Now, for a variable, it's easy. We just look it up in the assignment.
This is very much like evaluation. Only this time the valuation maps variables to members of the universe of discourse, which might be numbers or people or dogs or whatever. not to truth values. To interpret a term, we say, well, what are the values of the terms? What are the values of the arguments? Now we look up the function in the interpretation, and we apply that function to those arguments. Now, over here, the parentheses and commas stand for syntactic combination. Over here, these parentheses and commas stand for applying a function to its arguments. We've got the same kind of pattern we had last week when we talked about propositional doubtless and saying, on the one hand side, we've got some symbols that are talking about syntactic combinations. And on the other side, we're talking about actually carrying out an object given a set of values. Same kind of pattern. Now, we need two rules here because there are two kinds of term. We need to give how do you interpret this kind, how do you interpret that kind. We don't need a third rule because there is no third kind of term. This is just another recursive definition, like I was talking about last week. So what about sentences? Well, the bottom level for a sentence is an atomic sentence. And an atomic sentence is made by taking a predicate symbol and some number of terms and making a syntactic combination of that predicate symbol and those terms. And there aren't any other atomic sentences. It doesn't matter, again, whether we write something with an infix syntax or prefix syntax. That's just syntax. We don't really care about that. We've got the usual propositional connectives being applied to first-order formulas. And we could allow others, just as you can in propositional calculus. It doesn't make any difference. Okay. These are definitely enough. Finally, if x is a variable and phi is any sentence at all, then we can bind x in phi using one of these quantifiers. We could allow other quantifiers again, but you don't need to. All you need to care about is for all that exists. This is the purposes of the exam. So again, we've got a recursive definition here. Base case is atomic sentences. Then we've got things that combine existing formulas without introducing new variables. And finally, we've got some things that create new formulas by introducing new variables. And this, again, remember, is two key changes. So we've got variables, we've got predicates with arguments, and we've got quantifiers. These are really all that we change from propositional calculus, and it turns out to be a huge change. So what's the semantics? Well, every construction gets a rule. So our interpretation also has to interpret the predicate symbols. So a predicate symbol gets mapped to a function from the universal discourse, possibly many times, to the set of truth values. In Java, it would be a Boolean method. That's all a predicate is. So now we've got to say, okay, what is the meaning for atomic sentence? What's the meaning for not? What's the meaning for and? What's the meaning for or, etc., etc., etc.? What's the meaning for all? What's the meaning for exists? So for predicate, we do the same thing that we did with terms. We evaluate the arguments. We look up the predicate symbol to get a predicate. And we say, is this predicate IP, is that predicate true of those two argument values? Now, by the way, a key point here, when we evaluate, I'd better go back two slides. Okay. I really want a pointer. I really do. The result of evaluating a term is always a member of the universal discourse. That's obvious in this case. In this case, we evaluate this, we get this thing always doesn't yield, the mean function doesn't yield a term. It gives us a value in the universal discourse. So we're evaluating a function at elements of the universal discourse. When we get to doing this bit, there are no more variables. They've already been taken care of in there.
In the same way, when we ask about interpreting an atomic sentence,
we've evaluated the variables away. We're asking about the value of a predicate at elements of the universal discourse. There's no, this thing doesn't have to deal with variables anymore. They've already gone away. For the propositional cut connectors, it's the usual thing. On the left-hand side, we've got syntactic formations. On the right-hand side, we're carrying out operations on values. So over here, we've got an expression where the top operator is not, that's got one argument, which is phi. Over here, we apply n to phi, n to get a truth value, and we apply the not operator, so the not operation, to the truth value. So over here, this thing, phi, is a formula, and not is just a bit of syntax that makes a bigger formula. Over here, this thing is a truth value, and not turns truth values into truth values. And it's the same pattern for and it's the same pattern for the other propositional connectors. On the left, we're talking about syntax. On the right, we're talking about semantics. And again, by the way, we're looking ahead a bit. But the meaning that we give to that we assign to a formula, given the universe of discourse, an interpretation, and an assignment, the meaning that we assign to a formula or a sentence is a truth value. There's no trace of how that truth value was arrived at.
It could have been otherwise. We could have given some other kind of semantics. But in this particular case, that's all. What about quantified sentence?
Before I can say that, we've got to give this an idea of updating a function at a point. So what I'm saying here, if you've got some function f, and we want to update its value at one point, so we want to say the answer is going to be another function. And if that function's argument is x, the value we want to replace, then we use the value of v. Otherwise, we just give the same answer that f would. Okay.
Now, when people try to give a formal semantics for programs, this operation here is sometimes called nearing. An array can be thought of as a function with a finite domain. And getting an array element can be thought of as calling that function. In fact, many languages use the same syntax for array indexing and function calls. Replacing an array element can be thought of as replacing the whole value by an update at a particular element. And that is people commonly call this new. The idea here is we've got some function, we want to change its value at a particular point. Okay, so what about, now here I need to bring in I and V because we have a change V. For all x phi is true, if and only if it's true at I and V, if and only for all possible values in the universal discourse, replacing x, its variable, by a constant u in this valuation, sorry, in this assignment, makes phi true. And existential is the same thing except there is some u. And actually, the pattern here is over here, we've got a syntactic for all. Over here, we've got a semantic for all. Over here, we've got a syntactic exists. Over here, we've got a semantic exists. Now, the thing about this is, if somebody gave you a finite universe of discourse, and a formula with a finite set of variables, you could imagine writing a program to carry this out. The only reason why you wouldn't be able to carry it out
would be if these loops over U ran forever. Given a finite domain of discourse, you can actually check a formula. Now, this is a little bit of a warning sign. It says to us, you know, finite universes are likely to be easier to deal with than infinite ones. Surprise, surprise. But the semantics is straightforward. The semantics is just a recursive definition on the structure of a formula. For each possible formula, you look at what is the top construction, and that tells you uniquely what you've got to do.
Okay, we are on track for time. What about the unicorns? Well, if we write something like this in modern logic, and here I'm using U for unicorn, H for has horn, and D for is dangerous. So we've got for all X, if U of X, then H of X, and for all X, if H of X, then D of X. We do have the consequence that every unicorn is dangerous, but we don't have the consequence that some unicorn, that there is something that is a unicorn and is dangerous. We don't have that. Because, actually, in part because of our semantics of material implication. If there is nothing that makes, if there is nothing that is a unicorn, then for X, if X is a unicorn, then HX is true. How can you disprove for all X? How can you disprove every unicorn is a horn bearer? Well, you'd have to show me a unicorn saying, nya, 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 no horn. But you can't do that, so I'm right.
So there is this difference between modern first-order predicate calculus and Aristotelian syllogisms. There are some technical terms here which I thought I was going to need, but turn out not to. When you look at a particular occurrence of a variable in a formula, so down here you've got a formula P of X and it's Q of X, X occurs three different ways. There are three places and three different ways. So this occurrence here is bound. Whatever X means here is determined by this quantifier. This one is a binding occurrence. This is where X gets to be bound. This occurrence of X isn't in the scope of any quantifier. It's said to be free. It's a bit of terminology. This is not in the example I think it is. What's the equivalent in a programming language? Okay. We actually use the same terms in talking about programming languages. An identifier is bound if it is in the scope of a declaration that binds it. So when you say int x in Java, you are creating a new variable. That occurrence of x is a bound occurrence. When you then say later on, is x equal to 2, that occurrence is a bound occurrence because it's in the scope of the declaration. If you've got an occurrence of a variable that is not in the scope of the declaration, that's a free variable, and in a programming language, that's typically bad news. The compiler says, oops, I don't know anything about this. I don't know what type it has. Now, programming languages, this is a little bit of a digression from logic, but I want to make it clear to you that these concepts have some relevance to computer science. Of course they do. But programming languages have differed in how they treat free identifiers. For example, in Fortran, traditionally, if you had a variable that wasn't declared, the compiler looked at the first letter, and if it was one of the letters I, J, K, L, M, N, which happened to be the first two letters of integer, the compiler guessed you meant to declare it as an integer variable. If it was anything else, the compiler guessed that you meant to declare it as a real variable. Modern Fortran says don't do that. Okay. Identifiers should be declared. Because they've got a lot more types, it's not really practical to rely on this anyway. It turned out to be error-prone anyway. In Python, okay, you've got free variables and bound variables. In Tickle, a variable that you mention inside a function is taken to be local to that function, unless you explicitly import it from the outside. In R, if you have a variable in a function that's not declared there, it's taken to be an outside variable. So programming languages differ in the way they treat free variables, and this is a warning to us as programmers to say, if I'm going to be using some sort of scripting language, I'd better find out what its rules for interpreting free variables are, and I'd better try to make sure that I don't have any. I'd better find out how to say, give me a warning if I've got any free variables. In JavaScript, this is another one where there are rules here about this. A free variable in JavaScript is interpreted as being part of the outermost environment, which is the window if you're in a browser, and so on. What we're interested in is, when you're talking about the semantics of something, a sentence is open if it contains a free variable. In that case, a sentence with a free variable does not have a truth value because it depends on what the value of that variable is. A sentence with free variables is a function from assignments to truth values. So in natural language, we've got things like here and now that are a little bit like this. If I say it is not raining now, now is basically a variable that gets bound by the context. If I'd said that yesterday, I'd have been lying. And by the way, there's an implicit here. It is not raining here now. I'm sure there is somewhere in the world now where it is raining. And the sentence, it is not raining here now, would be false over there while it's true over here. So some things in English or any other language that look like logical sentences actually have implicit references to where am I? What time is it? Who's talking? I am male is a sentence that's true if I say it, and it's false if one of the people in this room says it, because it's a function from a context that includes things like who's talking. So when we want to talk about a sentence having a truth value, we have to be talking about a closed sentence that doesn't have any interface with the world except through the function and predicate symbols. Okay. Clickety-clickety, move on. So we talk about tautologies and things in propositional calculus. So we've got this notion of satisfiable and valid. So we've got the notion of given an interpretation I, a particular assignment satisfies the formula if and only if the formula is true under the model containing the interpretation and the assignment. Now, one of the things that we do with first-order predicate calculus is we might look for an assignment that satisfies a formula. We might fix an interpretation and say, find me an assignment that makes this thing true. A formula is satisfiable under an interpretation. It's not satisfied, it's satisfiable if there is some assignment that satisfies it. So a formula is satisfiable given an interpretation if it could be true, but it doesn't have to be true all the time. It's satisfiable if there is some interpretation under which it's satisfiable. Now, validity, then, is about formula being true under every assignment, and model where every assignment
So an interpretation where every assignment makes the formula true is said to be a model, and the formula is valid just by itself if and only if it's valid under every interpretation.
Now, what I care about here, what is the thing that matters?
What Martin asked about in this exam.
I don't really expect you to remember the idea about
valid and satisfiable, or what are the actual technical terms here.
What matters is the idea that the truth of the sentence depends on an interpretation and an assignment, and you've got three levels. Is it true under some particular interpretation? Under some particular assignment and interpretation? Is it true under some particular interpretation? And is it true under every interpretation? So the notion of true is not such a simple thing anymore. That's why we distinguish between being true,
which is being satisfied under a particular assignment and interpretation, being true under some assignment for a fixed interpretation, or being true under every interpretation.
Okay. So, how can we actually reason with this stuff? Last week, I talked about transforming a formula into a different version that was easier to calculate with. That's what I'm about to do now with first order logic. Now, the basic idea here is to move all the new stuff out that we can. We can't move variables out of terms. We can move the quantifiers. So, I don't know where prenex, the pre part obviously comes from prefix. I don't know where the next part comes from. But a formula is said to be in prenex form if it has a string of quantifiers and then a body, and the body contains no quantifiers at all. So all the quantifiers have been bubbled to the top. And so each quantifier is for all that exists. I'm not going to go into details of this because the equivalence tends to muck things up, so it's helpful to get rid of that. Now, to prove that this can be done, we need to do the same kind of rewriting, and we have to work recursively on all cases. And time really doesn't permit me to go into very much detail, so I'm going to go fast. I want you to get the idea. By the way, something I should tell you, and it will be sent out an email, tilde ok cos 14 books. I found a website with a whole bunch of books about logic and copied everything they had. I was looking for a particular one. By Gallier, who has written a lot of good stuff. The book is called Logic for Computer Science, and it's one that I benefited from a lot back in the first edition, and actually the second edition. However, it is much bigger than you can justify. I mean, read it for interest, but expect to be confused by different symbols. It is a great book. He has written some really cool stuff. But I just want you to know that it's there. If you want some books about logic, there are some really good books. There's a book called Logic in Rep, Logic in Representation, by Robert Moore, which I actually found quite valuable. Anyway, what I'm saying is the technical details are available here if you want them. Chapter 5 of Gallier, in particular, talks about this stuff. Now, the thing about this is, why might we even think of trying to move all quantifiers to the top? Well, there's a general sort of researchy thing. Do we actually need to mix the quantifiers deep inside things? Can we isolate things due to quantifiers from propositional type stuff going on in the body? But there's also the point that once we've got these quantifiers out of the top, we can manipulate the body as if it was a propositional formula. In particular, we can turn it into clauses the same way
that we turn a propositional formula into clauses. So it's separation of concerns. We're saying, okay, we've got these new quantifier things. Can we get them out of the way and do what we know how to do on the rest of the formula? So an atomic sentence is already in prenex form because it doesn't have any quantifiers. If we've got something where there's a quantifier at the top, then all we have to do is to compute the prenex form of the subformula and then just do another quantifier on the left. That's easy. We want to bubble other quantifiers up, and I'm going to do this for two connectors. AND and OR are left as an exercise. Implication can be done by turning that into OR and NOT. So here, to deal with NOT 5, by recursion, by induction, we're going from bottom to top. By induction, we can compute a prenex form to 5, and let's suppose that's it. We want to negate that, and that's where we use the rules. I do wish I had put an index onto this, the table of contents. Sorry, this is going the wrong way. This is where we need the De Morgan laws. Okay. We've got a body, we've got some quantifiers, we've got a negation sign. We want to push the negation sign through the quantifiers. And this is how we do it. We work from right to left. Okay. So not exists x is for all exists not. Not for all x is there exists x not. And it's the same thing, taking an equivalence and orienting it to turn it into a rewrite rule. But we can summarize the effect by finding the place. So all we do is we go through flipping, interchanging the rules and exists, and then we stick a NOT sign in front of B. So the induction step works for this, and in order, as I said, I'm going to leave as an exercise. The one I am going to cover is implication. And implication is quite interesting. And again, we've got some equivalences. There is an x such that A, that implies B. This is equivalent to, for every x, A implies B. Except that what we've just done with that, and I wish I had a pointer, keep saying that. When we move this quantifier up, why don't we turn the exists into a for all? That sounds like some sort of negation going on, and it is, because A implies B is equivalent to not A or B. But when we move X up like that, on the left it doesn't have anything to do with B. On the right, that X would be visible in B, and if X is mentioned in B, we're in trouble. That wouldn't work. So this rewrite, we've now got a conditional rewrite that says we can only do that if X isn't free in B. What happens if X is free in B? Now we appeal to the fact that the name of a variable doesn't matter. We change the name of X on the left to make it different from all the free variables in B. And all of the rules for this are the same kind of thing. We can take a quantifier inside one argument of a binary connector, and we can move it up to cover both arguments, as long as we don't capture a free variable. So we might have to rename that variable to something that's different from all the free variables of the other operand. So we've got four cases. Is it exists? Is it for all? Is it on the left? Or is it on the right? But it's the same idea every time. We want to move it up. These things are semantically equivalent, provided we don't muck up our variables. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why people put a fair bit of thought
into how can we have a language which is otherwise similar to logic, but in which there are no variables. So then we won't have to worry about renaming things. And yes, this can be done. No, you don't want to use it as a human being. It's convenient for a computer program, but... okay. So after we've converted something to Prenex form, we've still got a mixture of two kinds of quantifiers, for all and exists. Life gets simpler if we've only got to deal with one kind. We want to even throw away the quantifiers. We want to just look at a formula and say, okay, I see these variables here. They're all quantified the same way, so I don't need to be told. Well, we could in principle eliminate either, but the one we do eliminate is the existential. And this is... you know, I'd like to have a whole lecture on Skolem functions and Skolemizations. I really don't expect you to get this. I hope you'll believe me about this, and I hope you'll find the time to look it up. But the idea is that we get rid of existential quantifiers by introducing new function symbols. It does turn out to make sense, and it's something you can get used to the point where when you're formulating something in first-order logic, you find yourself introducing these functions directly, and you might even find a use for them. The idea is, here's this idea. You've got a sentence like, for all x, there is some y such that x is greater than y. Again, by the way, just a reminder, this is something that is true in some interpretations and false in others. It is true in the rationals. It's false in the natural numbers, because if you take x to be 0, there is nothing less than 0 in the natural numbers. So, what we're saying here, for all x, there is some y such that x is greater than y. And we're not saying it's the same x, okay? There's two different things. The order of, this is one of the reasons why we care so much about getting rid of the one kind of quantifier. If you've got a string of quantifiers that are all the same, they're all for all, or they're all exists, then the order doesn't matter. But, let's say for all x, there exists a y, x greater than y. Now, if we're taking this, let u equals, okay, the signed integers. Now, in the signed integers, for every x, there is a y such that x is greater than y, is clearly true. Just take y equals x minus 1. There is a y such that for all x, x greater than y, I take what y? No matter what integer I pick for the value of y, there is some x that is not greater than it. Okay. I can falsify this. If you give me a y and say, this is the one that you're looking for, I say, if I take x equals y, that comes out false. So these two sentences differ only in the order of the quantifiers, and they don't mean the same thing. Keeping track of that is a bit of a trouble. So what we want to do is we want to get rid of this. We want to get rid of the existential. And what we do is you say, okay, we've got this existential. How many existential is exists, universal is for all. How many universally quantified variables are there to the left
of this quantifier. And say, okay, I'm going to make a function symbol for that. So I'm going to say, for all x, x greater than, and this one says, we're saying x, there's some function that given an x will give me a y. Now this is not equivalent, these things are not equivalent. This talks about some function which might have to be interpreted. But here we're talking about something which is just going to be manipulated. If there is a function that's suitable and you can make it part of your semantics, that's good. What about this one? We're saying is a y. This y doesn't depend on anything. So this one turns, the second one turns into for x, x greater than c, for some constant c. And now looking at this, it's obvious that they have different meanings. So the, I mean, it's one of these things where you have to be very, very careful, and we don't really have the time to be that careful about what are we actually doing here. What we're doing here is a transformation that preserves satisfiability in a very carefully controlled technical sense. We're on track if I don't go... Okay. This is just at the moment. Take this as magic, okay? This is not in the exam. But it is something that's real. It is there. It is used. So, clausal form. First order literal is either an atomic sentence or the negation of atomic sentence, which is just like propositional case, except that the atomic sentences are more complicated. A first order clause is a set of first order literals implicitly joined by or, just like propositional. A first-order sentence is a set of clauses implicitly joined by and. How do we get there? Three steps. Step one, convert to Prenex form, move all the quantifiers out. Step two, scholemize, get rid of the existential quantifiers. Step three, then we're left with a body. We can just throw away all the quantifiers because we know that every variable that remains is universally quantified. We can reconstruct the quantifiers if we want them. So then we convert to clausal form just like propositional calculus. Why is that an interesting thing to do? Well, there's an inference rule called resolution. Okay. Now, this can be done in propositional calculus. We've got a clause that mentions P and another clause that mentions not P, and we can match these things up, throw away P, take P and what's there. And this is a generalization of most puns. Now, we could use exactly this rule on first-order clauses. The problem is the variables get in the way. We've got things that aren't the same, like P and P, but could be the same for some various variables. So there's a process called unification, and, oh dear, this is somewhat oversimplified. The basic idea is we want to solve, we've got two atomic sentences. We'd like to do some resolution. We'd like to say, let's cancel out these two things. But they're not identical. How can we make them the same? Well, we can make them the same by filling in values for the variables. And it's just solving equations. So we take our two atomic sentences. If they've got the same predicate symbol and the same parity, then we go ahead, otherwise we fail. Because there's nothing in P or M that we can change. The only thing we can do is put in values of variables. So if they if P and Q are the same and M are the same, we've now got to make corresponding arguments the same. So we've got to solve a set of equations. Now the empty set of equations is solved. Otherwise, we pick any equation from the set.
What do we do with one equation?
We think about the possibilities. A term can be a variable or not. We've got two terms, so there are four possibilities. If you think proof by cases or defining things by cases and is a common pattern in my lectures, it is. So if t and u are both variables, if they're the same, we've got nothing to do. If not, pick one of them, it doesn't matter which, and replace that by the other. If one of them is a variable and the other one isn't, then we should fail if the variable occurs inside the other thing, because we've been making a loop. Okay, if I wanted to solve, let's say I wanted to solve x equals 1 plus x. Well, the basic issue here is we want to replace variables by trees. We want to keep the fact that we're dealing with trees. And if we did that, then that would be equal to 1 plus 1 plus x. We'd get an infinite result. Not good. By the way, the programming language Prolog is based on first-order predicate calculus and based on resolution and based on unification, and it doesn't do that step of saying fail if the variable is inside the term that you want to replace the variable with, which means you can get infinite data structures and it's a pain. The third case is similar to the second. I've got a variable and a term that isn't a variable. How do I make them the same? I set the variable equal to the term. If you've got two terms, it's like how we started. If they've got the same function symbol and the same arity, we can add the requirement that the arguments are equal to the set of equations we're working with, otherwise we fail. So if you think of working with a stack of equations, at the end of the day, either we failed or we've got replacements for some variables. We say this thing that says, if you replace this variable by that term and this variable by that term, that thing's called a substitution. We can apply that to what we started with. And I skipped that detail in the slides because we don't have much time. So resolution has two operations, both of which are... There's two ways to describe resolution. One way uses a more complicated rule. In this way, it uses two rules. One of them says, if you've got a clause with two things in it that can be made the same, you can do that substitution, throw away one copy, and now you've got a simpler clause. You've thrown away one of the other clause. You've still got your original clause. The other thing is resolution proper that says, if you can make P and Q identical, then from A and P, from A or P and B or not Q, we can infer A union B with the variables that we've solved or replaced. And if you reach an empty clause without a contradiction, so a resolution theorem prover, you take the formula that you want to be true, you stick a not sign in front of it, you say, we're hoping that it's going to be valid. So you say, show me that it's not valid. Show me an example where it comes out false. And then rides away, if it reaches an empty clause, it says, okay, I found these values for these variables that make the whole thing false. And if it doesn't do that, then it was always going to be true. Any first-order proof that has a disproof has resolution disproof. This strategy of just these two inference rules is complete. You need to have a rule that tells you when to use which rule. But there are successful resolution provers that are theoretically complete. If there is a proof, they will find it. We don't have time to go into any of the heuristics that they use. This is why we care about resolution, because it is, in fact, useful. Resolution principle was discovered in 1965, and people started building theorem provers that used it shortly afterwards. So we've got a number of interesting properties now. We're nearly at the end. One of them is the completeness property.
if a formula is valid, then it has a finite proof. Not only that, it turns out that you can make that proof by taking a finite number of copies of the original formula, replacing variables with terms that contain no other variables, and then just doing propositional reasoning. The problem is, the thing that makes it an NP problem is that we don't know how many copies we're going to need. So we've got a search problem where we've got to say, well, if it's true, then I can show this with some finite number of copies. Let's try it with one copy. Let's try it with two. Let's try it with three. If there is a proof, it's going to stop. If there isn't a proof, it might give up, but it might keep on searching forever. So here's the crutch thing for computing. Validity is not decidable. There is no algorithm that always holds and says yes or no. It's said to be semi-decidable. If the answer is, there are algorithms which, if the answer is yes, they will halt in a finite amount of time and say yes. If the answer is no, they might halt in a finite amount of time and say no, or they might loop forever. And you can't tell, do I just need to wait a bit longer, or is this going to go on forever? Okay. Now, semi-decidable is one of these things where people say, okay, that's close enough to decidable to be worth a try. But it's also the kind of thing where you say, if I need a program that has to give me answers in a reasonable time, maybe I should do something different. So this is a bit of a warning. It says, if we go much past this, we're apt to lose decidability completely. This is obviously practical, but you know, people can't actually be doing formal logic proofs in their heads all the time. Yes. Otherwise, we see people freezing for days while they grind away looking for a proof. Whatever people do, it's not this. The other thing that this points us to is that first-order predicate calculus is much more expressive than propositional calculus. Maybe there is something in between propositional calculus and first-order calculus, which is computable but is rich enough to be useful for lots of things. When getting to the end, model existence, the set of formulas is consistent if you can't prove absolutely everything from them. So the thing about first-order logic is if a set of formulas is consistent, then it's satisfiable. The only thing that wouldn't be satisfiable would be something that was always false, from which you could deduce anything. And if something's satisfiable, it's consistent. So we don't really need to distinguish these concepts. The Löwenheim-Skolem theorem. This is an interesting one. It's a limitation on the expressiveness of first-order logic. If a first-order sentence has any model, it has a finite or countably infinite model. There is some model where there are no more things in our universe than there are natural numbers. And in particular, you know, the question arose, you know, we've got this first-order logic. Have we got far enough yet? Is this expressive enough to deal with mathematics? And it's good enough for most mathematics. It's good enough for talking about data structures in a computer program. It's good enough for talking about rational numbers. But real numbers are defined in terms of sequences and limits. And so you need to be able to quantify the sequences, but sequences are functions. First logic doesn't let you do that. Now, a particular application, it turns out to be even better than that, which is how come mechanical theorem provers that have no idea what the symbols mean can work. It says if a formula, now we've got this thing called the Hildebrand universe, and the Hildebrand universe is simply the set of possible terms that contain no variables. Now, if you don't have any constant symbols to start with, that can't get off the ground. So if you have no constant symbols, you add one, and then you can say, okay, so if we've got one, and if we've got plus, we can call one, one plus one, one plus one plus one, one plus one plus one, and so on, different ways. So the Hildebrand universe is the universe of trees made up of the constants and functions that appear in the formula. And if a formula in clausal form has any formula, has any model, it has a model in that universe. Theorem provers use that. Prolog uses that, the programming language. Next week, we're going to look at Datalog, and Datalog exploits that as well. Prolog and Datalog work in the Hildebrand universe. They still don't know what the symbols mean. There's something that we still can't say. We've mentioned mathematical induction. And here it is in some sort of logical formalism. For all properties P, if P is true of 0, and whenever P is true for N, P is true for N plus 1, then P is true for every natural number N. Now this uses no symbols that we don't have in our first order predicate calculus, but it uses them in a way that's not allowed. It's a type error, if you like. Quantifiers in the first order predicate calculus introduce variables that can be used to make terms. There are no variables that stand for predicates. Here we've got P being used as a predicate variable. In second order predicate calculus, variables can stand for functions and predicates, and that's what we need to say that, and we need to talk about the real numbers as well. Now, the higher order predicate calculus sounds like a really neat thing to use. It's a convenient notation for people. It's not so convenient for computers. People have written programs to work with second order predicate calculus and even higher, but these are things where your program may go into a loop. You may get lucky and get a proof, or you may not. And things can go into an infinite loop even when the answer is yes, not just when it's no. In terms of expressiveness, we want to go as high as we can. When people talk about natural language, there is a body of work called Montague Semantics, after Richard Montague, who wrote a paper called The Proper Treatment of Quantifiers in English, and came up with a way of giving a semantics to natural language sentences. And that uses Montague logic, which is infinite order predicate calculus, with modal operators and temporal operators and belief operators. You throw in practically everything because people can say practically anything. It's great that there is some sort of mathematical structure that we could use to give a meaning to human sentences. It's not so great that we can't really compute with it. And that's it. So, predicate calculus, atomic sentences have parts. The parts are called terms and predicate symbols. Terms are variables or functions applied to terms. We've got the semantics of these things. This is useful. First order predicate calculus does not exhaust everything that we might want to say. First order predicate calculus is just a convenient stopping point that's a really nice balance of expressiveness and practicality. And that's it. I've sent out email about the assignment, about how to hand it in, and